Well, our next guest on Downtown is the author of over three dozen books, including the Hockey Player Sonnets, You Can Always Eat the Dogs, and so many more. He is also the Poet Laureate of Brantford, Ontario, John B. Lee, joining us right here in studio. John, welcome to Bangor. Welcome to Downtown.
Thank you, Rich. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here with us. We've talked about your books. Bruce has read your work here on the show, and we're so excited to have you come on in.
Thank you,
Bruce. Brought your son with us as well, which is great.
Yes, we're down here to pursue Stephen King. We're looking for him.
Well,
we're stalking him.
Everybody knows where he lives because it's in my neighborhood, and regardless of the hour of day or night, there are people out there. Look for the crowd taking pictures of a house, and you'll know where he is.
And if you see a large busload of tourists jumping out and taking pictures, you'll know exactly where it is.
Exactly. We are a large busload of tourists all by ourselves.
John, you're considered by a lot of folks to be the greatest hockey poet around, and here we are on this very sad day. And of course, he was 88 years old, but still, they don't come much bigger than Gordie Howe.
No, he's wonderful, and Wayne Gretzky's favorite player, and of course, Wayne Gretzky's from the city of Brantford, where I'm poet laureate. So, and I just heard today. Bruce actually let me know about an hour ago. I hadn't heard, and it's a very sad day. I was already in mourning for Muhammad Ali, the great man who's being buried today.
Right.
And so it was kind of shocking news.
Hey, Ryan, can we cue up that final goal of Gordie Howe's career? Can we access that on the old computer? The last goal Gordie Howe ever scored and assisted by son Mark. Here's what it sounded like.
Ooh, going in, and Garrett will clear it to the other side for Mark Howe. Howe coming up on the right side. Howe over the line to his father, son to father. Backhand shot, they score! Number 9, Father Howe. And number 5, Mark Howe. And the crowd appreciates that.
Well, I'll tell you what, Danny, so do I.
Goal number 801 of Gordie Howe's career. Oh, and at the age of 52.
And a backhander. Nobody had a better backhander.
A nasty backhander.
Oh, Lord, he could rifle a backhander.
A powerful man.
Yeah, he definitely was. John, you have a poem you want to start this off by reading. It'd be great.
Sure. This is a poem about my mother and father's honeymoon, in part. Dad took my mom to a Detroit Red Wings hockey game in Detroit, on their honeymoon, and she describes it as having bought brand new high heel shoes, and they were in standing room only for the game. But it was the 1950s. The honeymoon sound of the puck on the boards. On their honeymoon, my father took my mother to standing room only Red Wings hockey game, where they perched in the dark, red-hearted heights. He in his wingtips, she in her brand new stilettos, and she was Grace Kelly beautiful, and he was handsome and slim, dapper with dark, thick, curly hair and the big car dreams of a farmer. And it was winter of 1949, mild in January, the weather strange, warm, snowless and grass soft, as it was with the ways of gentleness then, and the war was well over, with Howe on the ice, young and swift, while my mother suffered in silence for her tight shoes, her unnecessary girdle, her pinched smile. Soon enough for love, she would learn to stop singing, to refrain from dance, to no longer expect to go to the movies, to work in the kitchen, canning the apricot crop, to scald the jars and pluck the steam-feathered hens that lay headless and killed for the freezer, to wince at the sass from a teenage daughter, to puzzle over numerators with a son who understood the art of a good quarrel, to lose a baby girl only 3 hours old, and to live long enough to be the eternally sad widow turning photographs to write the names on the back, just in case someone should care.
Oh, that is wonderful.
I know. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens like that. You know, we talked to, when I talked to a couple of weeks ago about You Can Always Eat the Dogs, we had a a love affair with a guy named Jack Falla, who I knew was a writer for Sports Illustrated, who wrote two great books, unfortunately passed away before Rich and I could get a hold of him to talk. But he talked about his relationship with hockey. Why people think of baseball as the sport of literature, but I think of hockey as the sport of poetry. I mean, I really think there's so much. We've talked about Randy Maggs and Al Purdy and many things you've written. What is it that connects hockey and poetry for you?
Love. Love of winter. Love of the game. Hockey for me started outside in the burning wind. It didn't start inside the arena. There's a really different smell in the arena. You smell that kind of sporty smell in the arena. But if you've played if you've grown up playing hockey outside on a pond, on fresh ice, when you were blessed by it freezing smooth, that was like a mitzvah, like a blessing from God. And you would play all day. I was a farm boy, and, you know, sometimes on a Saturday or a Sunday, we would go down first thing in the morning, and we had ponds that froze over. There were gravel pits that were frozen over. And so for me, there was there were only two pieces of equipment, a stick and a pair of skates. And you would play on a really freezing, burning cold day. I'm a Canadian, so it was cold where I was. And you would soon start to shed your clothing. And the interesting thing, if you didn't put your skates on first and kind of ticky-tack down on your skate guards, you had to sit down by the pond in the freezing, burning cold wind and take off your gloves so you could tie your skates. And by the time you started, your hands were frozen, your feet were frozen, but it was just so beautiful. And W.P. Kinsella talks about playing baseball outside, and you could imagine the ball being struck so far that it could travel to the moon. If you played hockey on a creek, you have that similar feeling that if you took off down the creek and you didn't really know to turn around, you could skate forever.
I grew up playing hockey on ponds and rivers when I was younger. And one of the things I think that I've noticed that missed the minute I was always playing indoors. I went to prep school. We had an outdoor rink, and we're the only team in our league that did. And other kids would come down, and if it was cold, we would beat teams that were better than us because it's 15 degrees below with a wind chill, and we're out, and we're going, yeah, it's cold today. But there's something about the relationship with the cold and the people who grew up playing hockey in cold climates that I think is so magical in both the poetry and the hockey literature of Canada. Mm-hmm. As a cold northern place, I remember, I forget his last name, the boat, Alistair, help me, greatest Canadian short story.
McLeod,
thank you. Alistair McLeod, talking about what it is to write from the north, that sense that you are a northern writer. And mm-hmm. I find that in your work.
Mm-hmm. And I think actually, if geography doesn't defy me, that we might be further north here
we are.
Than where I am, where I grew up, because I'm deep in southwestern Ontario, which is roughly parallel. If you drew a line due west, you'd come about San Francisco, where I live. But it has reliable winters. I read a book about climate. And the 1960s were the coldest decade in the last century. So I grew up with reliable winters. I was a boy in the 60s. And so winter was reliable. And, you know, many of my fondest memories were being outside in the winter. Being a farm kid outside in the summer, you worked pretty hard. And what you wanted was shade. You didn't crave the sun. And all of the farm people that I knew, when you went to the beach, the first thing you did was look for a shady shady spot. So the winter, the outside, and the quality of light. I remember an occasion when we were playing inside in the St. George Arena. This was when I was an adult, and the hydro failed. It wasn't a matter of it being illegal or you know, a risk, an insurance risk. So we threw the doors open. And not only did the quality of daylight come inside and remind me of the difference between playing under artificial light and playing under daylight, but also that fragrance of the outdoors that you push through your nose when you're skating. If you've ever ridden a bicycle, you realize you push the fragrance of the ditch weed and everything through your nose, and it's a lovely olfactory experience. And skating outdoors in the winter and the smells of winter, and maybe that's one of the reasons memory keeps us sane, and writing, especially poetry, is about memory and nostalgia and fragrance. The smell of ice, the smell of winter, the smell of woolen mittens, the fragrance of your toque, the fragrance that's in your coat, and also the smell of wind when you're moving, and it's actually whistling. The wind is whistling in your ears the way it does on a bicycle because you skate very fast. All of that is part of the poetry of this beautiful game of hockey.
Do you think that's the reason that they tie together so well, hockey and poetics, is based on kind of like the elemental aspect of it, where, how do I want to describe it, where it's not just you playing the game, it's you playing against yourself, or it's you being together with nature?
Yes, but I also think that it's what you what exhilarates you. Language is exhilarating, to be fully awake and fully alive, and you can't be in a game and not feel alive.
Yeah.
And, you know, poetry wakes you up, revivifies, reinvigorates, stimulates, reminds, and awakens you. And so you can't play hockey and not be awake.
Still visiting in studio is John B. Lee, the poet laureate of Brantford, Ontario, sharing stories and poems this afternoon as he visits with us here. And hey, we're happy that we're also able to get a book signed by the boss, by Stephen King, for your son.
Yeah, that was incredible. You should have seen his face when I delivered that to him. He's a big Stephen King enthusiast.
Well, and our thanks to, well, obviously Steve, but also Bobby Russell for
helping Bobby Russell
facilitate all that for us.
Yeah, yep. Have you got another poem that you'd like to read?
Yeah, I thought perhaps because it's Muhammad Ali's, it's the day that we're honoring his memory. He was a great hero of mine, maybe one of the most famous human beings who ever lived, and very, very heroic in every way that one can imagine. And not just as a boxer, but as a human being, and so much of what he did after he died is in our memory. And I was in his museum in Louisville, but this short poem was inspired by reading poetry in Josh Conte's boxing club in Windsor. We have a thing where we read poetry and give books away in Canada, and I read to a bunch of young, aspiring boxers, children that were working out there, and I was amazed. They just looked at me with those big eyes and such admiration, and which really surprised me. So this poem is called "Wishing I Were Me." In the close torpor of the boxing club, with its salt sweat smells, its human aromas, its musty scent of stained leather and wet shoes, and its oddly midday indoor quality of light, like wind-drifting gauzy curtains and dust on glass and lonesome houses, I am reading poems with a turnbuckle to my back and the white mat at my shoulder, within the skip rope swish going thwick, thwick, like a slip-foot dance of the whip of little whirls of yellow earth, and the slap, slap of leather on leather, glove on glove, pop, pop, flat-handed philosopher, and naugahyde, pop, pop, and a point is made like the punctuated metaphysics of a palpable hit. And as I say, I am reading among these pugilists, these aspirants, who begin to gather in the sound shadow of my words. Mostly they are big-eyed children looking up in blue amaze, round-souled, astonished, making me wish I were me.
Oh, that is wonderful. John B. Lee with us in studio on this Friday afternoon.
You know, I there's another poem of yours that I love, Pity the Boy Who Believes, which talks a little bit about playing the game outdoors. I think one of the fundamental things that is missing in the States, and I don't know if it's as true in Canada, friends of mine tell me it is you go by the empty parks. You know, it's a beautiful spring day. There's nobody playing basketball, nobody playing baseball. I go by hockey rinks, you know, outdoor rinks, and see fewer kids skating. But you go to the public skate in the indoor rink, and you can't move. It's packed. It's packed with people. And I'm wondering if we've lost that sense that sports are an outdoor entity.
I haven't thought about that enough to know. I know that we could hardly wait to get out of doors when I was a kid. Even if I was watching a movie on a Sunday, I would watch half a Tarzan movie and then, you know, bolt out the door and be Tarzan outside.
Right.
Watch half a cowboy movie and bolt out the door and be a cowboy outdoors. Kids don't live in a vacuum, though.
No.
They do sort of what is expected of them, what's pushed on them. If you drag them out into the world, I remember one day, and we call it Blackout Thursday. There was a blackout in Ontario, and it was blackout from northern Ohio through Ontario, and it was community everywhere. People had block barbecues. Children and their parents were out playing in the driveway, playing basketball in the driveway, playing road hockey in the street. And I think, you know, in a way, we don't know what's good for us, because there was such joy. And then I imagine the next night they were inside playing video games and watching TV and falling asleep in front of the TV. So we don't live in a vacuum. If we lived in a culture that encouraged it, rewarded it, made people recognize how important it is, maybe we would rejuvenate that exhilaration that people feel by being participants. You know, they have a campaign in Ontario and Canada called Participation, and every once in a while they come along and promote that idea of getting out and playing. And I think it's kids don't know how much fun it is until you turn off the device, which they resist, and put it down, which they resist, maybe even with tears, and drag them outdoors, which they resist. And then when they've surrendered to the transition that you've forced on them, there's this joyful and ebullient participation in what we all know is good for you.
Well, and I don't know if they will. I won't call it the scourge. I'll call it the proliferation of youth sports is as prevalent in Canada as it is here. But we were fortunate enough to grow up at a time when you didn't need adults around to organize your hockey game, your baseball game, your football game, your basketball game. But these days, there is so much organization beginning at such an early age that we find that young people don't know how to play sports without adults there to organize things.
Wayne Gretzky has said that kids are overcoached and they're coached too soon. They should be allowed to be creative and learn how much fun it is. My own kids, before they got involved in hockey, I took them out to a skating clinic, and it just about ruined them because people were yelling at them. And both my older son never played hockey ever again, and my younger son played and had and played kind of house league. My son that's with me here played house league, and you can get under pretty bad coaching. And I think if you emphasize the idea of winning, as the ultimate objective of competition is meant to bring out the best in people, not winning so much as winning through, not having scored the most goals or defeated the other team, but winning through to the joy that's available in sport. When business, the trade that shook the hockey world, you know, when Canada woke up to realization that hockey is a business, when Wayne Gretzky was sold to Los Angeles, it was a really profound turning point in Canadian sensibility and Canadian consciousness in relation to the game, because we realized for the first time, oh, it's not our game. It's not a game. It's actually a business.
Now, my friend Brian Rogers, who's the voice of the St. John's Ice Caps, said, I felt that day we became the 51st state. Mm. I thought about that. I went, geez, Raj, that's pretty amazing.
Well, John, it's been an absolute delight for us to have you visit with us here in studio. Thank you. Thank you so much for spending time here this afternoon.
Thanks, Rich, and thanks, Bruce, and thanks to Silent Judy, and thanks for my son for being here. It's been wonderful.
Anytime you're here, come on back in.
I'm here tomorrow.
All right. We're not, so just shut the light off on your way out.
What about Bob? He hasn't gone away.